When all students are wearing the same school uniform, do their grades and behavior improve? That question's just ahead. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead, new research on school uniforms is out, just as Duval County considers whether to make them mandatory for kids next year. You can get on the line now with your comments at 549-2937. Then later, a look at Hunger Action Month on the First Coast and how you can help fight hunger in our area. Plus, the dynamic speakers of this year's TEDx event. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, it's a hot topic for parents, teachers, and students, school uniforms. Now, Duval County Public Schools may adopt uniforms for all elementary and middle school students next year. They'd be mandatory, but each school would be able to pick out the color and clothing for their uniforms. Duval already has more than 50 schools which voluntarily adopted uniforms. That's up from about 20 2 years ago. During the late 1990s, the entire district imposed uniforms, but they allowed students to opt out. So eventually, many kids just ignored the uniform rule. This would be different. It would be mandatory. Here's the question many have. Do school uniforms make a positive difference when it comes to kids' behavior and their academic performance? After all, that's the rationale for getting kids in uniforms. Well, UNF psychology professor Dr. Gabe Ibarra, who's also a child psychologist, recently conducted some research on that very topic, and he joins us now with some timely answers. Gabe, always good to see you. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
And we're already getting your calls. Here's our question to callers. When it comes to school uniforms in Duval County, they may be mandatory next year. Are you for that or against it? Give us a call. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show, or you can comment on Facebook. We're already getting your comments there on our page. And so you decided to take up this study. Was it in response to the news that Duval County might adopt uniforms next year?
Well, actually, we carried out this study earlier when Duval County had their voluntary option in place. It was fascinating to me that you could have a classroom setting where a mixture of children were sitting there with their uniforms on or in their casual clothing. I had a student who had children in those classrooms, and we came up with the idea to pursue this, to investigate.
So you did the study, and let's have the drum roll, please. What did the study show?
Well, the study, we sampled from three different schools, and it was a nicely diverse sampling in that we had a inner city school, a suburban setting, and a more rural setting. Duval County is big enough to do that. And we found that grades seemed to reflect a boost. There was a correlation of higher grades with the uniform-wearing children.
You found that when children consistently wear a uniform to school, they get higher grades.
Yes. We explored conduct as well. We found no effect. And it was probably due to these being elementary school children, not middle schoolers. In other school districts and other literature, we find that the attempt to impose uniform wearing is related to trying to quash any violence or aggressive behavior, any acting out. We didn't see that sort of benefit with these younger students.
And so no measurable impact on behavior, but an impact on grades. Why do you think?
Well, there were some obvious possibilities, such as the family's annual income and therefore greater resources in the household, factors related to the parent. So we did gather information related to the parents' education levels, the parents' ages, the annual family income. And we did find a relationship between especially the mother's education level was higher if her child was wearing a uniform. The family made more money annually. And the mother was slightly older if the child wore uniforms. So we controlled for those factors in our analyses, and we found there still was this higher set of grades among children who wore uniforms than for those who did not.
And are there contributing variables to that data point, Dr. Ibarra?
Yes. We only explored the influence in the classroom. So we explored what was happening perhaps with the teachers. So we had the teachers prior to an academic term predict how they thought the students would perform academically. We asked them to also predict about the students' upcoming conduct, their general behavior.
It's interesting because exhaustive national studies on school uniforms that they've been conducting since the 90s when this became popular haven't really found a measurable impact. But teachers, principals, superintendents like Nicolae Vidi, they see a difference in students' behavior and performance. There seems to be a gap between what the data sometimes shows and what teachers say they're experiencing in the classroom. Why do you think that is?
Well, what we enjoyed in this investigation was there was less contamination from outside variables because we had children in the same classroom at the same school with some wearing uniforms and some without. If we do cross-school comparisons, there could be a whole number of factors creating noise in the findings. You know, more resource schools, schools with teachers with higher levels of experience. So for us, it was a wonderful benefit to have a mixture of uniform, non-uniform wearing students in the same classrooms.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, on a hot topic as Superintendent Nicolae Vidi and the Duval County School Board looks at whether or not to impose a new rule for the next school year requiring all elementary and middle school students in our Duval County Public Schools to wear a school uniform. Now, there's going to be a huge community conversation about this before any such change is made. But as we discuss the UNF study results, let's have the conversation right now on this program. What do you think about this? Lots of calls. Let's go to them right now at 549-2937. Angela is at the beaches. Hey, Angela, good morning.
Hey.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a major problem with that because, you know, I've been a single mom for a long time, and I don't get to always go school shopping at the beginning of the school year for my kids, and it doubles my worries whenever I know they have to wear certain clothes. I mean, they do have some uniforms that they provide at schools where my kids have had to wear uniforms, but still, I don't want my kids to have to wear a certain outfit because it just puts more pressure on me and a mother. So I don't see where it would greatly benefit anybody. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me. It would just put more requirements on the parents who have enough going on already.
That's Angela in Jacksonville Beach. Angela, thank you so much for the call. Okay, so there's an anti-uniform parent. Gabe Ibarra, there are arguments pro and con, of course, to this. Meanwhile, Superintendent Vidi earlier this month said it was possible that the state legislature might pay districts an additional $10 per student as an incentive to adopt uniforms. That could mean $700,000 for cash-strapped Duval County schools. The district is being incentivized, possibly, to go in this direction.
Yes, we find, looking at other research on this topic and literature on it, that there are concerns by families, from families and parents about the initial cost, the startup costs,
right,
as well as maintenance. And usually the families with, say, more than one child, so more than one student possibly wearing that set of clothing for, through hand-me-downs, a child who has that initial set continuing to be able to access them to wear for the following terms or years, then we tend to see less concern among the families. But there is that initial investment, definitely.
Here's an email from Laura about this. I was one of those parents in the late 90s that was affected by the uniform issue. My son wore the uniform for 1 year, but then I opted him out because the cost of buying and maintaining the uniforms was a burden. Unless they can control the cost of uniforms, families with lower incomes can't afford them, especially for our larger middle school-aged kids. Lots of calls. Let's go to Hector in San Jose. Hector, what do you think about school uniforms?
Yes, I agree. I think it's a chance to give a young man a chance to dress like a man instead of some type of other individual with his pants hanging down around his butt. I think the uniform should be extremely cheap, white shirt, black pants, or either light blue shirt, dark blue pants, or whatever. It's something very, very cheap for the parents because the amount of money they spend on these zoot suits or these clown clothes that they send the children to school in, they could come out cheaper by buying this particular uniform, as long as it's cheap and affordable for all families. But some structure has to be done, particularly in a young man's life, to straighten him out, to know that he needs to conduct himself in a certain way. As far as the academics, no, it might not be the grade level, but it's going to cut down on the violence in school, and it's going to be a very structured environment where everybody looks the same, everybody goes home the same when they come to school. So that's my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Hector. That's the pro argument. Gabe?
We do hear a lot of that commentary and some of those findings in the literature as well, that there's a leveling of the playing field in terms of socioeconomic status. Doesn't matter if your parents make six figures or are scraping the bottom of the barrel financially. If you're wearing the same clothes, you can perform well and shine in ways that may be noisier if there are casual clothing differences that promote differences in the cost of or the emphasis of that value of outfit.
That's an intangible, isn't it? That's hard to quantify, the psychological impact of that.
Right. And our study didn't really explore that. We merely were focusing in on the teacher. Is there an influence there? And what we found, in a sense, confirms that adage that we talk about, we dress for success. We are concerned, or we should be concerned, about first impressions, going for job interviews or meeting someone for the first time. These students probably impressed their teachers, showing with this uniform on that they were there, they were serious.
So are the teachers subconsciously giving the uniformed children a higher grade because the child is in a uniform?
I would say teachers are human. They're influenced by outside, external factors. We have decades and decades of research that in psychology that human beings are affected by things like attractiveness. More attractive people win jobs faster than and receive higher salaries than less attractive individuals. So there's that superficiality among all of us to an extent.
Let's go to Mark on the West Side. Hi, Mark. What are your thoughts?
Good morning. With all due respect to your guest there, I could care less one way or another about if there's a percentage point here or there or of improved grades or anything like that. As a matter of fact, if uniforms had a negative impact, I'd want the school board to adopt uniforms. Anybody who's had kids who went to a public school and then maybe to a private school where they did have uniforms can tell you the same thing. It saves on so much aggravation, especially as they get into their teenage years, and hassle, and you never have those arguments about what to wear for clothes. I mean, I know parents who've had kids in public schools that almost have knockdown, drag out fights with their kids, especially it seems like their female kids, about what they're going to wear, what they can't wear. Is that 2 inches above the knee or below the knee with uniforms? It is just, there they are. They're clean. They're here. Jump in them and go. And that is it for years. It just saves so much aggravation and money. I heard a previous caller say they were concerned about cost. Yeah, you can buy a week's worth of uniforms for what you can on some of these, designer jeans or designer outfits. It's not even crazy. People who would get a taste of having their kids in uniform will never, ever go back.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark on the West Side. Danny down in Flagler County. Hi, Danny. What say you?
Hi. Well, I have two questions. I was wondering, by whom was the study funded? And number two, there's always, I'm not trying to play devil's advocate here, but there's always the probability that, these are his or their interpretations of the study. There's always a probability that there's something more insidious playing behind it. And just to give an example, there's been research out saying that the impact of artificial lighting in school, the actual wavelength of artificial lighting having an effect on kids' aptitude and their ability to focus and learn in school. Believe it or not, it's true. And so, how do you ever, you can't come you know, well, I won't say that, but how did they, you know, sort of factor those things in, those more insidious things into their results?
Sure. Thank you, Danny. Let's talk a little bit about how this study was funded and put together.
Right. The study was unfunded. So this came out of the blood, sweat, and tears of the two undergraduate research students. Emma Glencross, Deborah Monroe was conducting this research for her honors thesis at University of North Florida. So we didn't have a uniform company funding us. It wasn't like Gallo Wine and funding a research where now red wine's good for you or Nestle. With dark chocolate, it was unfunded. So there was no real dog in the fight. We had a mixture of opinions about it ourselves personally. But I think we did a good job of protecting ourselves and our data from bias.
Lots of comments on our Facebook page. Here are just a few. David, I think you have a small window of opportunity to mold a child. Uniforms in schools will help. These days, we need all the help we can get. Let's see. Robert, bow ties should be mandatory and not pre-tied. William, this is just another level of indoctrination. Lots of comments. Interestingly, all from guys. Maybe a lot of these guys had to wear uniforms. I don't know. Here's a tweet from Sandy. All sports teams have uniforms. They show where that person belongs and what job that person is there to do. Meanwhile, another tweet from Florida Politic, who manufactures, distributes, sells these uniforms, and what is their role, if any, in the rulemaking or lobbying of this? Getting back to the fact that the legislature might actually incentivize school districts to adopt uniforms. He's wondering if there's the hand of a lobbyist behind this. That's a question not related to your study, Gabe, but that's one worth looking at.
Right. When we look at local parochial schools and charter schools where uniforms are in place, most have a bank for families to turn in uniforms that have been outgrown or following their own students' graduation. And those uniforms are made available to families who are from lower socioeconomic statuses and where initial costs would be prohibitive. So I would encourage the power brokers on this topic to consider such options for our public school students.
Let's go to Colleen now in St. Augustine. Hey, Colleen. Thanks for holding. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, Melissa. I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm kind of laughing at the, conspiracy theory that's going out there about who's funding the study. I just have to say that I was a single mom in Duval County. And I think it was 95, 96, something like that, maybe 97, and they had a uniform policy go on. But you were able to opt out. So it sort of negated the whole idea of uniforms for kids. I loved it as a single mom. I could go buy, you know, 5 shirts, 5 slacks, 5 shorts, you know, and be done with it and not have to worry. You know, plus they were preteen girls and, you know, weird body issues and stuff. So it made everything really easy. But it seemed most of the folks opted out, and I just didn't understand how that went. But as a single mom, it was really great for me back then.
Thanks, Colleen. Now, what's different about this proposal, Gabe, as opposed to what happened locally in the 90s, is there wouldn't be an opt-out. This would be mandatory. How would that change the dynamic, in your view, in the classroom?
I think it would quiet yet more of the noise. Usually what we see is when there's a mixture, there's interplay between the groups. So we had, in our study, 179 students. We had 355 students overall who were followed in our three schools.
Which schools, by the way?
Well, I'd rather not say.
Oh, okay.
That we
all
have,
right.
We involved 44 teachers. I don't want to have them singled out knowing that they – when we tackled we've pursued students in grades 3 through 5, and it was usually a noisier situation when you have that kind of mixture because there's interplay among the groups. 155 of our students were uniformed, 179 were not, and then we had some inconsistent wearers of uniforms where some days they did show up in uniform, some days they did not. And interestingly, those inconsistent students perform the worst academically.
Here's a comment criticizing the way the study was put together on our Facebook page from Chip. The classrooms were split. The uniform children had higher incomes, highly educated mothers, and it's the uniform giving them an edge? He writes, this is more a case against uniforms. He also says that the study was aimed at the effect of the teachers. This is Survey 101 failure, writes Chip on Facebook, saying because you didn't sample in lower-income schools, for example, the socioeconomic impacts of how you did the study. What about that?
Well, no, we controlled for those factors statistically, so that wasn't that's not an explanation. We could have run including or ignoring those influences. We did not. We controlled for them. So
how do
the
you
grades
how do you
raised.
Control for them?
Statistically, you co-vary those factors out, so we recognize that there was a differential disbursement, higher income levels in the uniform families versus the non-uniform. So it's a simple statistical process of separating that out and seeing what's left.
Let's go now to Haley on the north side. Hi, Haley. How are you?
Hi. Good. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am from Louisiana, East Baton Rouge Parish. My mom is a school teacher. My whole family is school teachers. And in the early 2000s, late 90s, they first introduced uniforms and been doing it ever since. The good points would be, of course, having the same thing to wear every day, no problem. And it does help with income equality, but at the same time, poor parents or people with less money, you can tell at the end of the year, their uniforms are getting short, they're faded, they have holes in them, but they're still wearing them. So that's another factor. It's like, oh, you don't have as much money as someone else. And the other thing for me when I was in high school is that when you wear uniforms, it has to be enforced. And when it's enforced, it takes away from the learning experience. I've had TOR from missing a belt and forgetting my ID, two infractions that I've missed out on an entire day of school. So what's going to be done to enforce it without taking away from instruction? That's my question.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Haley. Those are all questions that I'm sure will come up when they go through this vetting process, Gabe. Here's an email from Carolyn. I am from the UK, where uniforms are standard. Stores sell very cheap multi-packs of uniforms because it's a no-risk market. When we return to the USA, it has cost me a lot more with my four kids. Let's put on Ellen. Ellen in the Intercoastal. Hi, Ellen. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning. I have two children. One is attending a public school and one is in private. And I will tell you that the uniforms, it does cut your time in half. I find that I spend less money on the child with uniforms than I do with the child who is buying off the rack and changing styles and seasons and that kind of thing. And I will say that we have purchased uniforms from anywhere from a uniform shop. You can get Walmart, Target, even Goodwill. And I'm not sure what Goodwill County will be doing, but if it's just going to be a generic, like, collared polo shirt, the option that's not embroidered with anything, the option to purchase those things, I mean, I even see uniforms for sale in Office Max. And so I'm not sure if schools are going to have different colors, but I think that it definitely saves you money. I can tell you from having two students, and you really do have to save money with uniforms because you buy what you need for the year, and then you don't have to think about it. So that's what we wanted to say.
Thanks, Alan. And if you're just tuning in, Duval County may adopt mandatory school uniforms next year for all elementary and middle school students. They may or may not, depending on how the community responds to the discussion. Lots of calls, emails, Facebook comments, and tweets. Let's go now to Tom on the West Side. Hey, Tom, are you still there?
Yes, I am. And good morning to you.
Good morning.
My concern here is I think no matter what you say about controls, I think the biggest indicator you're going to get with the students that excelled wearing uniforms is their parents were more involved. And I think that is more the biggest factor in their success than the actual wearing of the uniforms. And the other thing I want to say about this is I think it shows a concern here more along the surface level than the actual education. We changed the name of Westside High School, and the school then was rocked by scandal. You've got to get to the deeper problems rather than just the surface problems.
Thank you, Tom. That's Tom on the West Side. Gabe Ybarra, your study did find a positive impact, but what about the argument that uniforms are just window dressing, that they don't get at the root issues affecting student performance?
We want a variety of tools to help our children, to help our students maximize their learning experience. This is possibly one of those tools. So definitely there are other variables at play. Families are incredibly important. Parents, definitely so, in terms of emphasizing and highlighting the importance of study at home and disciplined effort. This study didn't look at that. That's a wonderful idea for the next study. We didn't have the option of pursuing and observing in the family of these 355 children. However, I agree that parents are definitely very important as well.
Let's take one more call. Dave is in Arlington. Hey, Dave. Good morning.
Hi. How are you doing?
All right.
Yes. I think that if nothing else, uniform creates a structured environment. That's why some parents pay $6,000 to $10,000 for their kids to go to private school, and they don't argue about it because they want that structure.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Dave. So your study's available. Where can people access this study?
Well, it's actually in review at this time, so I will gladly forward you some contact information when that's more available. But it's one of many that have studied this, that have explored this topic. We found benefit of with the uniform wearing. It was correlated with higher grades and yet not with conduct.
Fascinating to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Dr. Gabe Ybarra with UNF. And again, that uniform issue is still just being discussed. The school board will hold a series of community forums on this before ever putting anything to a vote. Much more still to come. Later, ideas worth spreading. We'll take a look ahead to this fall's TEDx Jacksonville Conference happening right here in our WJCT studios. But up next, how advocates are marking National Hunger Action Month here in our area. Back in a moment.
WJCT's Summer Sizzle Auction is where you'll find exciting items starting at up to 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Bid now. The auction continues through September 14th at 9 p.m. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information. Bid high and bid often. Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First is proud to present the 4th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. Saturday, September 12th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Tickets are only $30. Spend the day sharing ideas with colleagues, learning new ways to engage students, and empowering yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
There's a piece of the casket. Yep. That's it.
A cold case from the past is pried open.
So I've got some bones here that we're going to send into the lab. I've got the arm bones, two femurs.
Can new technology identify the remains of a young woman whose murder has haunted an Appalachian community for decades? That's on the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, an African-American doctor grapples with the health disparities between his white and black patients and the conditions that make it seem being black can be bad for your health. He was diagnosed with chronic health conditions in his 20s. We talk with Damon Tweedy about his memoir, Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, this month, September, is National Hunger Action Month, a coast-to-coast campaign when Feeding America and local food banks ask everyone to take some action to fight hunger in the community. Here in town, one leader who's made big strides in feeding the hungry and food insecure is about to move into the next phase. After he helped to found and establish Feeding Northeast Florida and served as its first president and CEO, Bruce Ganger has announced his retirement next month, but he joins us now with more about this ongoing effort, and it's great to see you. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Thank you.
And by the way, for all of the social media listeners out there, this is Spoontember. It's hashtag Spoontember. Look on my Twitter and Instagram and Facebook page today for the spoon selfie that Bruce and I took.
Absolutely.
You're supposed to balance an orange spoon on your nose as a way to talk about Hunger Action Month.
That's exactly right.
Which is a national campaign. Let's talk. Let's begin by talking a little bit about National Hunger Action Month.
Hunger Action Month is something that Feeding America has promoted for a number of years. And it's a way to just call attention to the issue of hunger across the communities that we all serve. And among the 200 Feeding America food banks, we cover every county in all 50 states in Puerto Rico. So we are really looking to bring national attention to the issue of hunger, the spread of hunger across the communities, and to then present solutions for that as well.
Here in our area, let's discuss some of the challenges that mm-hmm. you have addressed through Feeding Northeast Florida.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the needle on hunger unfortunately hasn't moved in the 4 years we've been at this. It's we still have 1 out of 6 folks in the general population who are food insecure. 1 out of 4 children under the age of 18. You know, you look at the statistics and they're shocking, and you wonder how can that possibly be? 29% of the people who are hungry have a high school or a technical degree or more, so they're very capable and looking for opportunities to go to work. 40% of the people who get food through our food distribution network are working families. So there's income in the home, but it doesn't get them from paycheck to paycheck. So food for many of these folks becomes the push.
These are low-income working adults.
Exactly.
And through Feeding America's network across, it's a 17-county area.
Ours is, yes. Right.
Yeah, across North Florida, you distributed last year almost 20 million pounds of food.
Right. But the studies that we did in conjunction with Feeding America show that we need to be sourcing and distributing 40 million pounds of food, which when you convert that, I mean, when I got into this 4 years ago, it's like, what's a pound? I mean, a pound. So a meal, if you will, if you convert that into meals, it means that we need to be sourcing and distributing enough food to provide 33 million meals just to cover those who are hungry today in the communities across 17 counties. That's a lot of food.
So how do we get from 20 million to 40 million?
Well, we've built a distribution model that is very scalable. It's very cost effective and efficient. We've driven the cost for the community to bear, the cost to distribute a pound of food down by 57%, so to 10 cents a pound. So we've built a scalable model now that is very cost effective, very efficient in the way we do this. So we have a plan, we have an implementation, and we're poised to be able to do that. We just need the community to help invest in it to make sure it can happen.
And in the year or so you've been running this, you've really reached out to the community.
Oh, yeah. We have from the very beginning said this is the community's food bank. So it will be what the community has asked us to build and be, and it will continue to provide that service as based on the community's investment and involvement in it.
I think it's hard for people to understand sometimes in such a wealthy country that we can have so many hungry people.
Yeah, it's really hard, Melissa. People ask me all the time, so Bruce, what's the solution to this thing? Well, at the end of the day, the solution to hunger is jobs. People would not choose to be hungry if they had a choice. Children would not choose to be hungry if they had a choice. And so the opportunity is, how do you spread some of the economic wealth to those 40%, those working families, those folks that are educated or have some training or some skill set, and is to provide that and to make sure that opportunity is presented to everybody who wants that opportunity to work or to progress in their life. And we're just not there yet.
Now that you're retiring from the job of distributing food,
are you pausing?
Are you, well, so you call it a pause?
That's a pause. That's
okay.
Not a retirement.
Not
it's
a retirement.
Right.
People don't retire anymore, really, do
no,
they?
No.
That's
no,
not. That's
not.
Kind of passe, isn't
I've
it?
I've still got a lot of gas in the tank.
That's right.
I just
that's
need
right.
to find another opportunity for it.
Oh, well, are you going to go from the food distribution game to the helping people get jobs game, because that's really what it comes down to?
Yeah, we still have some work to do with Feeding Northeast Florida and the community here to fulfill this. So it's I will assume a position on the board of directors and help from that volunteer leadership perspective instead of being a paid staff.
What can people who are listening to this, because you've been on a guest on this program many times, there are ways people can help. People so often want to help, but they don't know how to help.
Yeah.
So for people listening, if they're a mom, a business owner, an executive at a company, whoever is listening, how can they help?
There's actually four ways that we promote for people to help and move the needle on the issue of hunger in the community. The first is donate. So for every dollar donated to Feeding Northeast Florida, we can source and distribute enough food to feed 7 people. So if, you know, $100 feeds 700 people, so that's one. Another way is volunteer. We have a need for 20 to 25 volunteers every morning and every afternoon at our food distribution center on the west side. We have 23 paid staff. We'll have over 4,000 volunteers this year. Volunteers for us are the heartbeat of the organization to get the work done. The third way is to advocate. Advocate on behalf of those that you know are hungry or food insecure, somebody who's a child care worker, a medical worker, someone that sits next to you in your pew, your faith community. And then the fourth way is to educate, is to become more aware of the issue of hunger. Understand how people are hungry and who those folks are. So it's donate, it's volunteer, advocate, and educate are the four ways that we ask the community to get involved.
And someone's on the phone. We'll get them on the air in just a moment. By the way, the hashtag for National Hunger Action Month is hashtag Spoontember.
Spoontember.
How did this spoon selfie thing come about?
I'm sure there was a marketing company that came up with this great tagline. It has caught on like crazy. We had a network-wide conference call yesterday, and it's really taken off. So it's building a lot of momentum. It's pretty cool.
And it's an orange spoon.
Orange plastic spoon.
Why are we going with orange here?
Because orange is one of the colors of our colors, one of our two colors. And we wanted the orange as it's something that's sort of bright and bold and stands out, and it's pretty silly.
The warehouse for Feeding Northeast Florida, you said it's on the west side.
Mm-hmm. It's on Edgewood Avenue, roughly Edgewood and Commonwealth on the west side.
Edgewood and Commonwealth. Anyone that wants to go over there and help stack those shelves, they can always use that help if writing a check isn't something you can do. And let's go now to a couple of calls at 549-2937. Keith in Mandarin. Hey, Keith, good morning.
Hi. I'm trying to figure out where all of these feeding programs fit in. Now, there is there's a kitchen at a food kitchen at St. John's Catholic Church. The UCOM runs a food shelf. Second Harvest does quite a bit. And now, where does Feeding America come into this?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Keith.
Yeah, Keith, there's a number of ways to address a number of different types of programs in the community. And I want to make sure you understand that Feeding Northeast Florida is the replacement organization for Second Harvest. So that function, that Feeding America member and bringing all those resources into Northeast Florida is now the responsibility of Feeding Northeast Florida. There is no Second Harvest. With the other food, with the feeding ministries that you talked about, many faith communities, community associations, organizations across Northeast Florida who are rooted into the local communities are the folks who really understand and know who's hungry in the community. So they will provide cooked meals for seniors or for children after school, or they will have a food pantry that they provide at a building or a facility that they operate. Maybe it's a church, maybe it's a community organization or association. And then our role is to make sure that they've got food to be able to distribute or food that they can then cook and serve to those organizations. So if you will, we're sort of a wholesaler in the process. We have a network of 180 member agencies across our service area that are on the front lines of hunger and actually working with the individuals, the families, the seniors, the children that are hungry in those communities.
And you distribute to how many agencies?
There are 182, I think, is the number now, Melissa.
That's an incredible amount.
Yeah.
And it's Feeding Northeast Florida, distributing 20 million pounds of food last year to 17 North Florida counties. 1 in 6 people in this area is food insecure or hungry. 1 in 4 kids. September is National Hunger Action Month. So it's a month where we're all being challenged to do what we can to address this problem. And Bruce, I guess you're retiring on Halloween night.
Halloween. So again, it's kind of an orange spoon.
Yeah.
It's a Halloween.
Yeah, it's fitting. So kudos on all the wonderful service that you've given. And,
thank you.
And thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Melissa.
And in a moment, the ideas worth spreading of TEDx Jacksonville.
If you love All Things Considered, consider joining us a few hours early for Afternoons on WJCT. The Takeaway offers a fresh way to look at the news, featuring critical conversations, reports from the field, and listener participation. That's followed by The World, with engaging voices to illuminate what's going on around the globe and why it matters to you. It's the smart way to spend your afternoons. Weekdays from 2 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Follow what's happening at WJCT, even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen, or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Listeners love Relax Radio.
Hi, I'm Evan Willman. I typically listen to the station when I'm in my my home office. I work out of my house a lot. I have my HD radio in there. So this is really the best of all worlds. It gives me my news. It gives me music that constantly delights and surprises me.
When you make a $120 gift to WJCT, you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 for more information.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's the global phenomenon sharing ideas worth spreading. TEDx Jacksonville has announced a dynamic lineup of speakers and performers for its annual upcoming conference. This year's event has adopted the theme Into the Machine, and it's happening in October right here at WJCT. We've got a preview right now with executive producer Sabine Perwes. Good morning.
Good morning.
And one of the speakers this year is Kevin Hyde, partner at Foley & Lardner and former president of the Jacksonville City Council. Hey, Kevin.
Good morning, Melissa.
It'll be really fascinating to hear Kevin's topic, but first, Sabine, let's talk about this year's event, Into the Machine. What's that all about?
We really wanted to look at the systems around us. So the machine doesn't necessarily imply just technology, but political systems, PR, marketing campaigns, the systems that we've built and the systems that are in place, and how can we go in and disrupt and innovate in those systems.
And what I've noticed that's also new this year is you've got a mix of speakers, local, national, and international.
Correct. We have actually most of them are not from Jacksonville. 7 are coming in from other cities and countries, and 6 are local.
And one of those, of course, is you, Kevin, former president of the City Council, partner and employment attorney with Foley & Lardner. What are you going to be talking about?
We're talking about ex-offenders and how to put them into the workplace, really from two aspects. One, the economic argument for it, with the cost of incarceration being so high. Statistics prove that having ex-offenders in jobs reduces recidivism and clearly reduces the burden of the cost of incarceration and just the social good that comes from having people at work rather than being in jail.
What is your goal for getting up on the stage, giving a TED Talk, which is going to go all over the world? You know, this is a worldwide thing, which is exciting.
The first goal is not to drool on myself. And really is to promote this idea that we need to remove employer fear about hiring ex-offenders. We need to show what the argument is for doing it. And so it's a way to start a conversation. When I was on the city council, we passed some legislation that would make Jacksonville as an employer that had to give full and fair consideration to hiring ex-offenders. So it's a baby step toward just getting the ideas out there. This is a population that needs to be employed.
Now, Sabine, as you said, there's a really dynamic roster of speakers. They come from places like Detroit, Tunisia, Chicago, all over the place. Locally, we have Kevin, we have Peter Rummel, attorney John Phillips, and a few other names people in town might recognize. Mm-hmm. Local performers, including Canary in the Coal Mine, the Ritz Chamber Players, Al Letson, of course, affiliated with WJCT. TEDx is affiliated with the global TED Talks. And for those who aren't familiar with TED, can you explain a little bit about why TED has become such a global phenomenon?
So TED stands for Technology Entertainment Design. And 6 years ago, they allowed those of us in cities and states and countries across the globe to really hold local conferences with local content that's relevant for those cities. And it's empowered these TEDx's to go ahead and move an idea forward. And TED actually incorporates some of these talks onto TED.com as well.
When TED Talks really go viral, they can move the needle on important social issues. Can you give an example or two of how a TED Talk has made an impact on an important issue?
Absolutely. I think if you look at Shaka Singer, actually, he gave a TED Talk last year. He's a former murderer who was convicted and has served his time and has come out, is now talking about that experience and how it transformed him. And he is going into inner city youth schools and addressing the Black male population there, and has really made a profound impact. And he'll actually be here with the Operation New Hope conference later in the year.
What do you think it does for Jacksonville, Kevin, too, to have TED's brand, its imprint here in our city this way?
Well, TED has become such an international phenomenon, as you said. It's one of those brands that you know, somewhat like a Coke, that when you hear it, you know what it means. And to have Jacksonville associated with that and the diversity of speakers that Sabine and her group have put together, I think it really gives Jacksonville an opportunity not only to highlight the local issues, but to see how Jacksonville fits within the broader context. So it's quite exciting.
Now, I've heard through the grapevine from some people that have given TED Talks that they really put you through your paces. So tell me a little bit about your rehearsal, Kevin Hyde, because I've heard it can be pretty intense.
Well, I'm actually rehearsing tonight with Harolyn Sharp. She's a professor of speech at FSCJ.
Okay.
So we're getting to know one another. And I haven't been edited and critiqued this much for quite some time.
That's what I was going to say.
And he's going to be doing some improv on Sunday just to get
really
his juices flowing. Yeah.
Interesting.
It's going to be difficult.
Oh. So Sabine, you get someone like Kevin Hyde or whoever it is out of their comfort zone a little.
Absolutely.
Right? Like you're getting them to explore new aspects of themselves.
We want them to look at it as a completely new experience. This is not the regular speech that they've given. The audience wants to interact with them before, after. And we just want them to see how to give the best talk to deliver their idea forward.
Is it your hope that, because people will be in the audience, several hundred people, but anyone can access your talk online, and you want people to, Kevin, to really download this, not just the average TED fan, but people in positions of influence in this community as well.
Well, ideally, certainly those people, but for instance, employers that are looking at hiring ex-offenders, maybe I can say something that will spark an idea that it's okay to do this, and here's some reasons that should be hiring ex-offenders. So if it could have that effect, I would view that as very positive.
So it's still coming up in several weeks, Sabine. People can still snap up some tickets.
Ticket sales went online today at 8:30 a.m., so everyone can go to TEDxJacksonville.com. And one new thing that we've started this year is we're actually going to be providing content at two libraries live from the event. So this will be the Webb Westcanaught branch and the University Park branch. And that information will be available shortly as well.
So if people don't want to buy a ticket, they can go to the library to watch for free.
Those two library branches will be hosting the event.
Very
right?
Nice. Yeah. But of course, I'm a little biased toward WJCT, which there's going to be a lot of energy here that day. It'll be exciting. And it's exciting to host it once again this year. Again, it is TEDx Jacksonville. Coming up next month here in our WJCT studios. Tickets are on sale today at TEDxJacksonville.com. An incredible lineup of speakers, including former City Council President Kevin Hyde. So, Kevin, I know it's going to be a good talk.
Thank you.
It's like I said, I've heard that they really, really make you rehearse.
I really want to know your source now.
I have several sources on this. Okay, so you guys do a wonderful job.
Thank you.
You leave nothing to chance, so kudos.
Thank you.
Kevin Hyde and Sabine Perwais, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Our daily podcast is on iTunes and Stitcher. And next on Diane Rehm, Germany pledges to take in 500,000 refugees a year. Denmark is discouraging new arrivals, and the Obama administration considers its options. World response to the accelerating migrant crisis in Europe. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.
Education coverage on First Coast Connect is made possible in part by a grant from the Chartrand Foundation.